Welcome to Holden Village. In the Creekside Room, today's speaker is Tom Pearson, and he will be doing a session entitled Mountains, Volcanoes, and Earthquakes. So, let's listen in on Tom.
What I wanted to do with this topic today was to try to give you an overview of the big picture of the processes involved in building mountains like the Cascades, and how such catastrophic events as volcanoes and earthquakes play a role in that, and how if we live in an area that has mountains, we really can't escape volcanoes and earthquakes too easily. The kind of the big story that underlies the history of these mountains is fairly recent. And that has to do with a revolution in the thinking of geological concepts that has occurred over the last about 30 years now. There has been a complete overturning of the once accepted theories of how mountains were made and how geology worked on a worldwide scale that occurred in the late 60s. And this revolution in thinking is almost has no precedence in the history of science. Maybe it's sort of like when Copernicus hypothesized that really the Earth was not the center of the universe, but in fact the Sun was, and the planets, including Earth, were really revolving around the Sun. I mean, it's that kind of an upset in the way of thinking about things. So let me give you a little history about what led up to this revolution and how it has changed our thinking about geology and the Earth and how mountains are made. Really, people have had theories about the Earth as long as there have been people. And the Aztecs, for example, believed the Earth was the back of a giant turtle that sort of made its way through the universe. We remember from our history books that early Europeans, even up through the Middle Ages, believed that the Earth was flat. And you'll recall that the early explorers setting off on their explorations of the heading west from Europe to see what was out there, it was feared by most people that they would fall off the edge and never return because it was, of course, a flat Earth. Nineteenth century geologists, and this is really when science really started to bloom, had a number of theories about the Earth. And they made a number of observations into which these concepts, any hypothesis or any theory about the Earth had to fit. One was that they could see that rocks in the past had been molten. They observed volcanoes in action in places like Italy and Greece. They could see in the rocks in the British Isles and in Italy and places like that, that as we saw on our hike yesterday, there are rocks which obviously had been liquid at one time and had been ejected or injected into other rocks in some sort of a fluid fashion. So they knew that these rocks had been molten in the past. And they could also see from rocks that they had compressional features. These rocks had been squeezed and compressed. And we saw some evidence of that too yesterday in the rocks, where we saw the little folds in the gneisses out there showing that this compression had occurred. In other places, the Earth shows evidence of tension or a pulling apart of the Earth's crust. And they noticed this too. Some of the best examples of this are in the western United States. In the area we call the Great Basin, geologists call it the Basin and Range Province, and this extends basically from Utah through southern Idaho and Nevada into eastern California and eastern Oregon. And this is a part of the country where there's a whole series of linear mountain ranges that run north-south, and then these flat-floored valleys in between, and they're just fairly regular going across the country. And the early geologists mapped these and got a very good understanding of them and realized that the crust had pulled apart there, and I don't know what an analogy might be, faults formed, cracks formed, and as the crust stretched, some pieces of the crust dropped down into the gaps left by these cracks. And the mountains, it wasn't so much a question of the mountains going up, but it was the valleys dropping down due to the spaces made by the pulling apart. And then it's really been observed, as long as we've had fairly accurate maps of the world, that there are some curious fits or seeming fits between continents. Some of the best examples of this are between the eastern coast of South America and the western coast of Africa. And geologists and geographers way back were, you know, snipping out these maps and putting them together and realizing that there was a very close fit. And then as geologists started making geologic maps and going to these places and actually seeing what the rocks were in these places, they realized that when they reached the east coast of South America, things stopped there. They could pick up the geology, the same rocks could be picked up on the other side, on the west side of Africa. And it's the same eastern side of North America. The Appalachian Mountains can be picked up in the mountains of Scotland and in Scandinavia. So there were all these bits of information that our early geologists in Europe and North America tried to rationalize and justify. And the first one they came up with is they figured, well, it must be a shrinking Earth. They knew or suspected that the Earth had had a hot beginning, because of course there were lots of volcanoes in the past and they could see this in the rocks. So maybe what's happening is that the Earth is just cooling and shrinking, and that might explain the wrinkles that form the mountain ranges. Well, they ran into a problem with that explanation, in that these stretching features, these tensional features, such as the basin and range province, didn't fit with that. They couldn't explain those features by a shrinking Earth. And then a little later, they came up with the idea, maybe the Earth is actually heating up, and this coincided with the discovery of radioactivity in the late 1800s. By Madame Curie in France. And so thinking, well, there must be a lot of this radioactive material in the Earth. Maybe actually the Earth is instead heating up and expanding. And that might explain it. But then they had trouble fitting in these compressional mountain ranges with an expanding Earth theory. And then in 1912, there was a German geologist by the name of Alfred Wegener who proposed that actually the continents had fit together. He had compiled a lot of this information about the geology on both sides, and his hypothesis was there was something called continental drift. These continents had once been together and separated apart. But the one shortcoming he had was he couldn't think of a good explanation how this could possibly happen. No, and as a consequence, no other reputable geologist bought into his theory. He thought that somehow the continents were like ships that were kind of sailing along and breaking their way through the rest of the crust, separate from the crust that was under the oceans. So that didn't work too well. And really up until the early 60s, we didn't have, and this is a time when I was in college, we didn't have a really good all-encompassing theory for how all of these different Earth processes worked. In the 60s, there started to be a collection of different bits of information that started pointing the way to a new theory. And these were one that as a science or a sub-science of geology called paleomagnetism evolved, people started looking at rocks and the those little black minerals that we pointed out in the rocks that we saw yesterday, such as hornblende and pyroxenes, and then some of the oxides of iron like magnetite and hematite. These iron-rich minerals act as little magnets. And when an igneous rock cools and freezes, those little magnets are frozen into an orientation that is parallel to the way the Earth's magnetic field was aligned at the time. And as data started coming in from rocks from different parts of the world, they realized that all these little magnets in the rocks weren't pointing to the same north magnetic pole. In some places they pointed one direction, in other places they pointed another. Well, some of these rocks were different ages, so they had a stopgap theory at the time. Well, maybe the poles, the magnetic poles, were just kind of wandering around. Maybe they're just not fixed where they are today in the north and the south. Then an additional fact was realized about the Earth's magnetic field, and that was that the poles actually reverse and have reversed a number of times through the history of the Earth. That is to say that what we know as the North Magnetic Pole today has not always been the North one. At one time it was the South Pole. And down south, the North Magnetic Pole was down there. And we know that this flip-flop has occurred many times. The last one was about 800,000 years ago. Now, one of the interesting things is we still don't understand is what happens when this reversal takes place and whether or not there are serious intrusions of cosmic rays that occur when the Earth's magnetic field does switch. We don't know if it dies down to nothing and then builds back up in the reversed form, or whether there's just kind of an overnight switch. And it's there's some concern about that, because our magnetic field is what really protects the Earth and life on Earth from damaging cosmic rays.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Tom, what is the average length of time between reversals?
It's highly variable. Highly variable. It has gone as long as many tens of millions of years. There was a period back in the Cretaceous period during the time of the dinosaurs when it lasted for something like 50 or 60 million years, if I recall correctly. And other times it's lasted only a few tens of thousands of years. But anyway, this discovery that we had the poles were in different positions and that they reversed themselves was kind of a startling bit of, or two startling bits of data. And then this is also corresponding with the time when the science of oceanography is really getting going in the 60s. And oceanographic expeditions were sent out by universities, and they really started to do some serious mapping of the seafloor. And maybe you recall seeing National Geographic articles back in the 60s when they started showing maps of the seafloor, which showed things called mid-ocean ridges. And the first one they really pinned down was the mid-ocean ridge between North America and Europe, the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. And interestingly, this Mid-Atlantic Ridge is halfway between North America and Europe and between South America and Africa. And its alignment is, again, parallel to this boundary between the edges of these continents. So in 1962, a professor from Princeton University named Harry Hess proposed that such a thing as seafloor spreading occurs. And so he had a mechanism now which could include Alfred Wegener's idea of continental drift. And his hypothesis was that new crust was forming along these mid-ocean ridges. And that as this new crust welled up along these mid-ocean ridges, it would spread and take the continents with it. So if you'll pardon a very crude map here, let's have a sort of a North America with Mexico. And out here is a mid-ocean ridge, and then we've got be kind of like Great Britain and Spain, and then the Mediterranean. Oh, this is pretty bad. But anyway, then we get Africa kind of coming in there like that. And so he had a mechanism that really started to make sense, and geologists started really scratching their heads and thinking, well, maybe there's something to this. Well, then, in the late 60s, a couple of guys, again, connected with a university, this time Columbia University, decided, well, we know that the Earth's magnetic field has changed, is reversed, we know that we have a hypothesis here that the seafloor is spreading. Maybe, as this new crust is formed, and as it forms here and then starts going off in different directions, it should record these reversals in the polarity of the Earth's magnetic field. So they went out there with an expedition and started dragging magnetometers back and forth across the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. And lo and behold, what they found was an almost perfect mirror image on either side of this ridge of these reversals. And I'll use the wide chalk lines to indicate the positive or the normal, what we have today with the north and the north. That's the normal polarity. And then in between they had areas of reversed. And so ended up with a pattern that kind of looked very much like a barcode on one of these tags that you take to the checkout stand today of normal, reverse, normal, reverse, normal, reverse. And it was a mirror image, symmetrical, about on either side of that ridge. And then as geologists, oceanographers started doing the same thing in other oceans and other parts of the world, they found exactly the same thing. So finally, we had then evidence that allowed for an explanation for how continents could actually drift and move on the crust of the Earth. And so in the late 60s and early 70s, this revolution occurred. And it was really an interesting time to be studying geology, because I had some professors in college who were, you know, firm adherents to this new theory, and others who just thought it was the biggest bunch of hogwash they'd ever heard in their lives. And the debates would come to fist fights at times between, you know, opponents and proponents of these new theories. It was really an exciting time. And geologists sort of scattered about the world going out and looking for evidence that would either confirm or deny this new hypothesis. And as I mentioned once before, the very nature of science is that when there's an idea like this that seems pretty attractive, most scientists will go out and try to disprove it. That's just kind of the nature of how science goes. Scientists are trying to get at what the real answer is here, and so that they go out and see if they can disprove it, and so they did. But when they started coming back with their data, all their data started supporting this new hypothesis rather than knocking it down. So really, within a decade, this really took on the status of a new theory. A theory being a hypothesis which is nobody's been able to shake. It has good supporting evidence and has really become established within the literature. So it is now the pattern and the main theory by which we explain how the Earth works.
Question?
Yeah.
Everything's spreading, but the Earth isn't getting any bigger. so someplace things got to be going together.
That's exactly right.
You're going to get there?
I'm going to get there.
Okay.
That's not. I'm glad you're thinking ahead there and looking at, because that's exactly right. You had to have a mechanism to take up the slack of these different spreading centers. And so what we have are basically then three types of margins. Well, first I should say that what this then shows is that the Earth, and a lot of this background information had already been known at the time, that the Earth wasn't one solid chunk of something. We knew even before this that the Earth was made up of a core, and then a zone around the core called a mantle, and then above the mantle there was a crust, and the core is believed to be solid, most of it, thought to be solid iron and nickel. Then there's this mantle is kind of a very hot and plastic and ductile zone, and then on top of that again is the rigid crust. And the crust, or actually they think of it now as the crust, which has the rocks no, are really brittle, and then there's a fairly rigid zone under that, which is part of the mantle, and they call that whole zone the lithosphere. This lithosphere is proportions. Imagine if we had an egg that's perfectly round rather than egg-shaped. The thickness of the eggshell would be approximately proportional to the thickness of the crust and lithosphere that we have on the Earth now. So it's a fairly thin shell, and it's broken into a number of different plates or sections. So if you imagine an eggshell that has a bunch of cracks in it, all of these then broken sections of eggshell are able to move with respect to each other, and it actually is quite complicated motion. In some places they're moving apart, in some places they're moving together, and in some places they're moving sideways, side by side. The place that you probably all are familiar with in North America here in the United States is a fault called the San Andreas Fault in California. That is a junction between two plates, and again, let me see if I can have a kind of crude map here. And Baja California, Mexico, and here's Washington, and we're up here. Okay. California is something like this. And not quite what it does there. Okay. But anyway, we've got a fault that comes up, right? It's actually a series of faults. The San Andreas is just one of the big ones that comes up. But a series of faults that come up through California, and the motion is like this. The rest of North America is going this way relative to this bit of this oceanic plate, which is going this way. And there is a lot of friction along this fault, as you can imagine. And the rate of spreading, what happens down here is that this breaks up into a bunch of little spreading centers like this, so that the crust is, let's see, right, going the right way here. Spreading apart along these crusts, along these cracks. And I don't think I have my sense of motion quite right there, but this oceanic plate is then coming this way, this one is going that way relative to each other, and the rate at which they're passing each other is 3 centimeters per year, approximately. So with all this friction going on, what happens is a constant rate of strain. The friction along the fault prevents that strain in most places from moving, or the strain from being shown by movement. So what happens is it builds up. It's like compressing a spring. And the crust is elastic to some degree. So it's built up an elastic strain. And then periodically that strain has to be released. And so suddenly there is a lurching forward of the fault. And when that happens, shock waves then radiate out from the point at which that break occurs, and we have an earthquake. Not all the zones along the San Andreas Fault, not all of them have that much friction. Some of them are loose enough so that the friction is actually, or the motion is actually going on constantly. And I forget the exact zones. There are a couple that are sort of halfway between San Francisco and Los Angeles, where farmers have built fences across the fault, and they've built roads and things, and then just a few years later, they see these cracks appearing in the roads, and all of a sudden, the fence starts to have a little wow in it, and their barbed wire starts getting really tight, and they have built right across the fault, and they didn't know it. The last big earthquake in San Francisco, the Loma Prieta earthquake, was not on the break was not on the San Andreas itself, but on a nearby subsidiary fault. So the strain is taken up on a whole parallel band of these different faults. But it's a constant ongoing process here, and it's one reason, or the reason, why California always has and will always have earthquakes. It'll also mean that eventually, the way I've drawn this is not quite right, because San Francisco is on the North American side of the fault, that one day Los Angeles and San Francisco will be right next to each other. But it'll be a little while from now. The other, when we get up to where we are, up here, what we have then is a spreading center that's kind of going like this. Yeah, my sense of motion is I don't have enough of the geometry here to make it all make sense, but this part here is spreading away, and we have a place off the coast of Oregon and Washington where then this plate, this oceanic plate here, is meeting the continental plate over here, and they're colliding. And in cross section, that looks sort of like this. The oceanic crust is thin. It's only, well, in places out near this, near the spreading centers where it starts, it's only a few kilometers thick. It gets a little thicker coming in here, maybe 10 kilometers thick. And it's made primarily of a rock called basalt. But it also has a lot of sediment on it from all the sediment in the ocean. Has a layer of sediments that get carried into this juncture here. And here we have this is the continental crust, which is much thicker, and where we have the Cascades. And this is what is primarily producing the compression that is responsible for relative motion this way, meeting a plate coming this way. And the rocks reflect this. Here in this zone in here, we get a bunch of highly deformed oceanic sediments, which are essentially the sediments on the plate that are just scraped off underneath this mass of continental crust. And the example we have of this is the Olympic Mountains, which are primarily oceanic sediment with some volcanic rocks, which have been scraped off the crust as the crust has been subducted. That's the term we use for this underthrusting of the oceanic crust. Then in this zone here, we have continental rocks, but we have a lot of compression. We have a lot of folding and faulting of the rocks, because under heat and pressure, the rock is able to become plastic. It's able to deform and gets heated up due to this high compression. And the other part here is that this part of the crust gets down maybe 50 to 100 kilometers below the surface. This oceanic crust starts breaking up, it starts melting, and then the big blobs of melt, which happen to be more or less dense than the rock around them, the mantle that's down here. These are like big teardrop-shaped blobs of molten rock, which are buoyant, and which start moving upward. And they will move up into the crust, and they are buoyant enough that they can actually force their way through the rock in the crust itself. They do that partly by melting their way through the crust, and partly by just the force of the buoyancy pushing the rock aside and making their way up. When one of these blobs of magma gets close enough to the surface to actually have access to the surface, it forms cracks which radiate out, and sometimes these cracks intersect with the surface. And when that occurs, we get a pathway for this magma to come out, and we have a volcano. Now the main mass of the molten rock is usually at some depth, and it sends up little pulses of magma, which produce the eruptions like we had at Mount St. Helens. The Mount St. Helens eruption in 1980 used up all the magma that was in that pulse of material. But we know that deeper down, there's still a large body of magma waiting to send up some more stuff. And if it sends up enough up into the zone that's right underneath the volcano, we'll have to get ready for another eruption. This magma moving up, when it gets up within about 10 kilometers of the crust, it's quite easy to pick up the sound, essentially, of that magma breaking its way up through the rock. It causes earthquakes, this breaking action. And it's the primary way by which we can predict volcano eruptions, by listening, using seismometers, and measuring these small earthquakes. We can measure the progression of the magma upward. So, and then the one last part of that, if we have a big blob of magma that comes up in here but never makes it to the surface and just cools in place, it becomes what we call a pluton or a batholith. That's a big mass of congealed igneous rock with fairly large crystals because it cools slowly. And it then becomes the granites and the granodiorites and the diorite, these large crystals, largely crystalline igneous rocks that we see, such as right around here. We saw on our walk yesterday, like the diorite. And eventually erosion of the mountains, because this kind of crust here is more buoyant then the denser mantle underneath, and as it's being scrunched and made thicker, it wants to go up. There's a kind of a natural buoyancy effect here that pushes it up, and at the same time, erosion is taking it down. So eventually erosion will take it down to, you know, maybe this layer here. And it intersects these large bodies of crystalline rock, and that's the condition we have today here in the North Cascades. We can see these masses of once deeply residing crystalline rock, and they're now exposed to the surface, but that's through the erosion of the whole mountain range. This process will probably not go on forever. Other variations on it is that there could be another mass of continental crust that might come steaming along that's embedded in the oceanic crust. Maybe we have another whole continent that would be coming along like this. And you can imagine when one is being subducted under the other, there's going to be a crunch point coming up here where these two masses of continental crust just collide head on. And that has happened geologically recently, in two places that you're familiar with. One is the Alps, the mountain range in Europe, and the other is the Himalayas in Tibet, in India, where two, in the case of India, this the whole, what we call the subcontinent of India, was a separate continental mass which crashed into the underside of Asia. And in fact, it's a young enough process that it's still uplifting very, very rapidly. And the forces of erosion can't keep up with this uplift, and that's why we have such high mountains in the Himalayas. They're going up much faster than they can be worn down. Yeah.
What is that continental crust? You say the granites and stuff are coming up through the blobs and magma, but what is the basic rock of the continents?
These zones of former mountain ranges, which over the time, many, many cycles of this occurring, have been worn down. In fact, what we have today in the central U.S., we have an old mountain range which doesn't have any topographic expression anymore. But the rocks are, you know, highly deformed, highly crystalline, and it's called the Canadian Shield. And it's what underlies Minnesota, Wisconsin, and all the prairie provinces of Canada. It's a big zone, which was a mountain range that had gone through this whole thing. It's now the center of the continent and makes up kind of the guts of the continental crust there.
We were drilling wells. I was drilling wells back in Wisconsin. We go through the various layers of limestone, sandstone. Then we hit granite, and we knew we quit then because we hadn't hit water then. Wrong gun.
Right.
But so what was that granite, the original crust?
It was some of this original, right, some of this old roots of the mountain range that were overlain by some younger rocks, the limestones and the sandstones and stuff, that are sitting on top. Now this is that what we call the Canadian Shield, or that crystalline core of the North American continent, is in fact a whole, it's not just one, it's several episodes of mountain building that occurred, and the thing has happened so long ago that it's been totally flattened.
But it's mostly granite, those things are?
It's a lot of granite, yeah. Yeah.
So how has it been flattened?
Erosion.
Oh, it's just erosion?
Erosion. And it stopped going up, because what happens is that when the collisional forces meet enough resistance, usually what will happen is that, for example, if this one collides with that one, eventually it'll break off and it'll start subducting in a new place, maybe over here. And then this subduction zone will stop and heal. And so they're changing position.
on and off. So a continent gets to be a continent by lots of these collisions of material coming in and accreting itself or adding itself onto the edges. And we're sort of building out from that with, we have that core in North America, and then we have the Appalachians, which is a fairly old mountain range, but it's younger than the core, the Precambrian core. Then we have the Rockies, which is younger still, and then we have the Cascades, which are younger still. And moving out, yeah.
Okay, so what's in the plate that's developing the North American plate again?
Here in Washington and Oregon, it's called the Juan de Fuca plate. It's a small plate.
And it's still subducting?
And it's still subducting, yes.
Still pouring?
So this is still going on under us right now. We don't, sometimes in this place here, we see a topographic trench. Mm-hmm. But we don't see that here off the coast because there's so much sediment being provided by the erosion from the Cascades that it fills it in with sediment. We don't see it, but this is still going on. Occasionally little chunks of small little microcontinents come floating along, bits of old crust from elsewhere, and they come and get subducted in and plastered on against the Cascades. That has happened several times. For example, Vancouver Island is a bit of exotic terrain, they call it, one of these little microcontinents that came sailing in on the plate that was moving in, and it slammed into the side there and stuck. The San Juan Islands in Puget Sound are a little sliver of crust that doesn't belong to either the Cascade region or to Vancouver Island. It's separate again, totally separate. And so we often get these different terrains adding on to the edges. And it makes the geology in the mountains very complicated. The fossils, for example, on Vancouver Island have a lot more in common with fossils in Asia than they do in other fossils in North America. So that's one of the hints that Vancouver Island was a little strange even before they could explain it by this continental drift theory. Yeah?
The Coast Range, like in Astoria area, mm-hmm. predominantly mudstone and sandstone, but the bigger rock is basalt.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend and I have been out kind of hiking around, and it's almost impossible to find any basalt here. Is that...
Here?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there isn't. Well, there's light. If you go east a little ways and get onto the Columbia Plateau, there's more basalt than you'd...
But isn't that the first magma that's cooled and like out of volcanoes? So why is it not here?
Okay, good question. Basalt is what we call a kind of a primary magma. Mm-hmm. And the composition of everything that's kind of underneath the continental crust is thought to be of essentially basaltic composition. And this new crust that's forming out in the ocean is basaltic. The reason you see basalt in the Coast Ranges is that it's bits and pieces of this oceanic crust together with the sediments that was sitting on top of it that has come into the edge of the continent, has peeled off, has been scraped off, and is now plastered onto the edge of the Cascades. So that basalt is oceanic basalt. There's also an exception there in that we have a big basalt province here in eastern Washington, the Columbia River basalts, which actually form from vents near the Idaho, Washington, Oregon borders, where all three states come together. It came out in just tremendous volumes between about 12 and 17,000 years ago. About 15 to 17,000 years ago. That basalt was so voluminous that it flowed down the Columbia River as rivers of lava and went all the way to the coast. And in fact, flowed down the coast in some places. So some of the basalt that you see around Astoria
and even a little bit further south, is actually Columbia River basalt, which has a different origin than this oceanic basalt. But the basalt in the Olympics, there's a lot of basalt in the Olympics, and that's oceanic basalt.
And you see all pillow lava and stuff like that over there.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And you do see a lot of pillow lavas in the oceanic basalts, because pillow lavas form when the eruption is underwater. Right.
Would that be the reason when you go up to Cape Alava and you start walking south on these little beaches, each beach seems to have a different quality to it or texture to it?
Well, the reason is as you go south on the Oregon coast, there are lots of these
up north Washington coast. But
oh, the Washington coast. Okay.
Yeah, for people out there, you can hike out. You know, like was that? I don't know if you've done that or not. But
long time ago.
Yeah. These bays, as you go through, there's even these round rocks that I don't know, they're like bowling balls.
Yeah.
Why they're there, I don't know. But
concrete.
Yeah, they're
anyway, as you move along, each beach seems to be a little different.
That's mostly just due to the irregularities in the rock itself, and some is a little harder than others. The basalt is much harder than the shale and the sandstone. So where you have basalt zones, that will preserve better and stick out into the ocean and resist the coastal erosion better and forms the rocky headlands. Where you have the indentations with the beaches, that's where the softer sedimentary rock is sitting. And those bowling balls, which are really interesting, those are concretions, and they form as kind of like a crypto fossil almost. What happens is there'll be a little piece of shell or a bit of calcium carbonate fossil which was deposited in the sandstone, and then that acts as a seed to form kind of a crystal of calcium carbonate around that bit of shell, and it forms in three dimensions. But it's not in an open space, it's in the little spaces in between the sand grains, so it actually then forms the cement, a harder cement within the sandstone. And it kind of grows out in all three dimensions pretty much equally. And so it's a lot harder than the surrounding sandstone, so when it eventually weathers, it weathers out as these cannonballs or bowling balls. Yeah.
I always wondered how they form.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if you go at them with a sledgehammer and break them open, you'll often see some really nifty little fossils inside. I've done that and found beautiful scallop shells right in the very center, and in some cases crabs, fossils of crabs, or even fossils of fish themselves. Let's see if I've kind of forgotten anything in the basic stuff here.
Up at the museum, Coral Museum, they have maps showing these ridges and all that sort of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And they just came back to do it. But one thing they talked about are hot spots. They say that are moving or not moving or mm-hmm. something. Like Yellowstone is a mm-hmm. hot spot that used to be under someplace else here. Huh? What is that?
Okay, that's a good question.
that's
a real good question. The stuff that's under the crust, the lithosphere, as I said, is plastic. It is, in other words, it's a very viscous fluid. And there's a convection that occurs. It flows. It moves. And it's. We don't know exactly why these occur, but it's like you know, when you put a pan on the stove to just put it to boil, and pretty soon you'll have these zones where the water is coming up, which is a little hotter than the rest of the water around it. A convection cell starts. Well, these convection cells sometimes concentrate in certain areas, and so there's actually kind of a flow of actual material, but also then of heat. When we get a big blip in the mantle, we have a real zone of high heat flow coming up this way. And because it's connected, it's actually in the mantle, not in the crust that's moving over the surface. The crust is moving. This is staying relatively in the same spot. through the life of this convection cell. So the crust is passing over it, and this high heat then is causing melting and melting under the crust, and causes a lot of volcanic activity to break through to the crust, due to this concentration of heat from the hot spot. Now, as you might imagine, because the movement is occurring, this is staying still and the crust is moving, what we get is things like islands of, I'm going to have to change this a little bit to show you how the Hawaiian Islands got formed, because the Mid-Pacific Rise is on the other side. So in this case, we've got, here's our spreading center. We have new crusts coming up and forming this way. And so what we have are volcanoes that were formed from the hot spot. We've got one today that's going on. That's the island Hawaii. Kilauea volcano, which has been continuously erupting now for about 8 years without stopping. But then as we move west, there is a series of other islands making up the Hawaiian chain. Molokai and Oahu and Kauai. Kauai being one of the ones that's way out here on the edge, on the western side. And they are progressively, they get progressively older as you move from east to west. And Hawaii is the manifestation of one of these hot spots that periodically was just pumping out lava. The Yellowstone hot spot is another one, although that one's under continental crust, and it's thought that the eruption of the Columbia River basalts has something to do with that hot spot, because that hot spot has migrated from the Idaho area, and then there's a volcanic zone in southern Idaho, you know, that sweeps across. So that's a trace, and they get progressively younger as it goes from the western border of Idaho, gets progressively younger, ends up in Wyoming at Yellowstone, and that's the Idaho, that's the Yellowstone hotspot.
So these geysers and all these hot springs you see in Yellowstone, they're caused by this hotspot pushing up them?
Well, that's the ultimate cause.
Yeah.
Yellowstone itself is a huge volcano that last erupted about 600,000 years ago, but there's a huge mass of slowly cooling hot rock. Well, we don't know how how cool or how dead it is yet, because it's possible that it could erupt again. In fact, our office makes measurements of the land surface, and we're seeing deformation of the surface. There's actually quite a bit of uplift that's going on in the Yellowstone area right today, due to some of this pressure from the magma underneath.
So that entire park is a volcano, basically.
Yes. Yeah, it's a huge, what's called a caldera. It's a volcano that's so big it doesn't have just a single cone, but it's a whole zone. It's many tens of miles in diameter. And the last time it erupted, it essentially decimated all life in the central United States. Most of the ash went east. And Colorado, Nebraska, Kansas, all in there. There are very thick deposits of ash from that eruption, and lots of fossils of mammals that were caught in the ash and killed. And it would have would have been black for days. The ash would have been so thick that sunlight would have been excluded for many days.
Well, the Badlands are a big layer of ash, aren't they?
Well, the Badlands are older units, and a lot of it is volcanic, yeah, from older volcanic periods, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and the question is, why? Why are the continents drifting? Why is it spreading here? What, do you have any idea what the mechanism is making this movement? I mean, something got to push it.
We are still working on that question.
I understand your answer. You don't
There's there is a new technique in medicine, you know, like a CAT, called CAT scan.
Uh-huh.
And I forget what the exact all the initials stand for in a CAT scan, but the T stands for tomography, and that's a technique by which they essentially are looking at the passing of sound waves through something and then how the sound speeds up or slows down with respect to what it's passing through. We can do this with the Earth too, with seismic waves, with earthquakes. And with computers now, we can do the same thing. We can we can analyze it so that we're looking at just a slice at a time. And this, with this technique, we've got these slices through the Earth now, all the way to the core. And we see that the boundaries between the core and the mantle, the inner core and the outer core, are not nice, smooth boundaries. They are like inverted mountain ranges. It's really lumpy and very strange topography and the connections between these different layers. And again, suggesting that there is very uneven heating and convection causing this movement of mantle material. And so we think it has something to do with convection and with the internal heat source within the Earth.
Is there any evidence that there was other or different spreading areas than there are now? As if one of these convections quit, that's causing the spreading in this spot and start up over here?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. The spreading will start and then stop. There's a place in Africa called the East African Rift Zone. The Rift Valley. And that is an aborted mid-ocean ridge. It started to split the continent of Africa, but then for some reason stops. And so it started to rift apart. Another one is the Red Sea. It's kind of part of the same system. Where there, it split apart enough to let the ocean in, but then it stopped again. And then we have things like the Appalachians, where we had compression coming together, but then for some reason it decided to split apart very close to the edge of that compressional mountain range and start going the other way. It started splitting apart and formed the Atlantic Ocean. So yeah, through the history of the Earth, these things are starting, stopping, crunching together and pulling apart in a very complicated history.
Is there any relation to this with the reversal of the poles? How does that tie in, and why does that happen?
Oh, that's a good question too. We don't really know why the poles reverse. Since there is this convection, we think it's like a dynamo effect. If you move a hot convective fluid, you can induce a magnetic field if it's a conductive, if it's conductive for electricity. So we think that this convection is actually producing a dynamo within the Earth and causing the field to form that way. Why it stops and reverses, I guess there's some theories by the people who really study that, but I don't think they have any one that everybody's agreed on.